is proving to be expensive. The vending machine companies fought back the only way they could. They improved the technology. Salting was eliminated by moving the coin changer to a different part of the machine. The channel is now long and perforated, so salt water can't flow through it. The bill validator is mounted above the slot, so nothing can gain access to it. Older machines were fitted with diverters that channeled fluids away from the coin mechanism, but allowed coins to have their travel their usual smooth path into the coin acceptor and changer. Bathing the coin slot of a dispenser with a saltwater benediction to gain a freebie is now a thing of the past. Very few machines that could be influenced by such a baptism are still around, making this a pointless exercise in futility. It's still one that will get you in trouble with the law, though. You know, Walmart has... how much? Well, Walmart is the only place I see. They have like 35 and 40 cent soda can machines. Do you think it might be because they're recycling old machines? You know, information provided on mental illness as a technology and vice versa is provided solely for the education and entertainment of our audience. Any information used in the commission of illegal activities is not advocated by Free Radio Asheville or your host, even though the reception of it... Hold on, we have a pop-up ad with information regarding something you can do in your spare time. Hit us. Okay, so you take clear tape, you put it, you make it the same size as the bill, so it's not sticky. Put the bill on top. Clear pieces of tape. Clear piece of tape. You let it slide in a little bit. Then you pull the bill back out. Aha. Uh-huh. So you use like what? Packing tape or scotch tape? Like packing tape. And it has to be the same size as the bill?
Yes.
Same width, but not the same length. Because you have to be able to pull it back out. How do you keep it from ripping the bill? It slides off. Have you ever done this? Okay. It works. Yeah, but you can do it all night long. You can end up with more than 156 cans of soda. I would like to say again that Free Radio Asheville does not condone the information of the Commission of Illegal Activities using information gleaned by listening to mental illness as a technology and vice versa. But if you would like to know more that you can do to gain access, you can listen to Off the Hook every week at what time? Saturday at 12, you can listen to Off the Hook, which will give you more information related on hacking and freaking and information access, etc. This is still to come. We have my interview with Inga Muscio, author of Cunt, The Declaration of Independence, and her forthcoming book, which she has just finished, Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Devil. A lot of you who listen to free radio or internet radio are also into the underground press. You may know about zines. It's not quite Fact Sheet 5, but Zine World is a great resource for information about zines. A great jumping on point if you would like to know more about the independent press, but don't have a lot of knowledge right now. If you'd like a copy, it's available for $3 at Zine World, P.O. Box 330156, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 37133. That's Zine World, P.O. Box S-B-O-R-O-T-N 37133. One more time, that's Zine World, P.O. Box 330156, Murfreesboro, Tennessee 37133. And an example of something they might review. One of my favorite zines Zen Baby. Zen Baby is anything but Zen, put together in a frenzied cut-and-paste style, with text jammed into every nook and cranny. Mostly a poetry zine with contributors, which results in some really good stuff and some banal. Politics figure heavily, with rants on Bush, Kerry, and the occupation of Israel as some of the topics. Offers a unique perspective in that the editor is a pre-surgery trans male coping with a brain injury. Christopher's writings on his own life experiences and what he wants out of life provide the most compelling reading. Lots to read, good value. Zen Baby is an excellent zine that I enjoy a lot, especially if you're interested in kind of an alternate perspective on the mainstream. The author has spent time in jail and been homeless and is transgender and has a lot of other things that make him an outsider, yet he's a joy to be around and to listen to anyway. If you're interested in getting a copy, you should write to Christopher Robin, P.O. Box 1611, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Christopher Robin, P.O. Box 1611, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. He was actually the person who told me that the FCC had raided Free Radio Santa Cruz. He's a good source of information. And if you do decide to write to him, send him a couple of dollars for a zine or whatever, be sure to mention that you heard about him from Andrew Octopus on mental illness as a technology and vice versa. I'll be reading some more zine reviews of zines that I like in the weeks to come. But now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Inga Muscio, author of Cunt, A Declaration of Independence, which is one of the most important and influential books of the 1990s, and her forthcoming book, Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Devil. She will be appearing in North Carolina at doing a workshop at Duke University at the beginning of next week, I think March 7th and 8th. And then she'll be making an appearance at the UNC Chapel Hill campus bookstore, the Ram's Head, later that week. So you should be able to find out more information about that at the web pages for Duke and Carolina. Here's us. The only thing I know about your new book is the title.
Mm-hmm.
So could you tell me a little bit about it and what led you to write it?
Do you know the subtitle?
Just give me the full title, please.
The title is Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Devil. Uh-huh. My life and times in a racist and perilous society. So that's what it's about. My life and times in a racist and perilous society.
What do you think is some of the most important things going on right now? As far as developments in relation to the racism and imperialism?
In the world?
Or on any level that people may or may not know about.
Well, I think it's the most important thing going on right now. That's a really broad... Can you narrow that down a little or something? Like...
Okay,
In what manner of existence? You mean in terms of racism and imperialism only?
What do you think... Well, when I do research, when I start to look at things, I'm always amazed at these... In things that seem enormous, that are just kind of bubbling behind the surface, that you'll never see on, like, the 6 o'clock national news or on the cover of the New York Times, but it's undeniable that they're happening, and they really frame the way that people see the world, where they really... are an enormous deal in people's lives, but they're just never openly discussed in mainstream media. So I was wondering if you had anything like that that you're seeing that's going on that you don't think people may or may not know about, but is probably influencing their lives in an enormous way, if that makes sense.
Well, I guess one of the most important things that I see, like a pattern it's really broad too, but it's of, there's a tendency, especially, I can only speak for the United States because it's the only country I've really experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a tendency in the United States to, to believe that our country is founded on freedom and democracy. And I think from that basic assumption forward, there's just nothing but confusion and chaos and false assumptions and unexamined ideologies and beliefs and political systems and economic systems and everything. So, I think that right now it seems like more so than ever in my lifetime, the terms freedom and democracy are like just repeated daily in the media and out of people's mouths, and yet I don't think anyone really has ever stopped to define those terms either as individuals or as a collective consciousness as a country. I don't think that we've ever really stopped to think about that. So there's a whole slew of problems that have obviously developed from now. I mean, I think many of the problems in the world at the feet of the of myself, of people in this country. No.
Yeah, I definitely understand that.
Our willingness to abide life while our government is committing atrocities across the world and in our own country, and you know that's been going on over the past 300 years since America was a country. So I mean, things going on now with like George Bush, you know, and people getting all pissed off at George Bush, it just doesn't work for me.
Because it's...
Yeah, he sucks. So what? He doesn't suck any... I mean, he sucks in a different way than every other president that we've ever had in this country. You know?
Yeah. That makes sense.
And he sucks more openly. He's committing more crimes openly than presidents in the past have in this country. You know? And in a way, I can't fault him that. It's like, it's kind of refreshing in a way to have somebody just like, where everybody can just look at him and be like, wow, this is messed up. You know? But to look at that and isolate it and not see it as a continuum and look at it in our own prison system and our own ghettos and the reservations in this country and the rural coal mining towns and agriculture communities and you know, small town America, and see what's happening is, you know, that's just ridiculous. So I guess that's a big thing that I trip out on a lot, is everybody pointing fingers at, you know, this one man without looking at ourselves.
I've seen a lot of that too. I think there are people who hate George W. Bush more than they like themselves, more than they like anything else. They're kind of defined by being anti-Bush. Without really, you mentioned that you think one of the big issues is the lack of a real debate about the definition of terms like freedom. What do you think that? What does that mean to you, or what do you think the best definition of it is, or
of what freedom?
Yeah, you said that you don't think people really stop to think about what it means, that it just gets used without being defined.
That's funny. I just turned in the glossary for my book today, and freedom is one of the words in the glossary. I've thought about the definition of freedom quite a bit in the past few weeks. Actually, in the past year, I've been thinking about how I was going to define freedom in my book. The definition that I come up with is that freedom means many things to many different people. And that is that. It's a really simple thing to say, almost trite. But if you really look deeply into how many different people there are on the planet, and how many different things define freedom for everyone, I think that's where you come into some like pretty interesting ideas about freedom. Freedom is, you know, if you can imagine someone and imagine someone's life, or imagine yourself and imagine your life, you know. Then freedom, you can imagine, you know, what freedom is for you. It might not be what it is for someone else, but that doesn't make it, you know. Freedom is, like, in flux.
Mm-hmm.
it's a fluid concept.
Do you think that people are uncomfortable with things that can't be easily defined or concepts that may have to remain fluid?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like in, I guess in the mainstream, the concept of freedom is, well, America gets to do whatever the hell it wants, and that's freedom. America, you know, I don't know. America is a superpower, and so we get to do whatever we want. And if you question that, then, you know, you can't deal with freedom or something like that. It's quite odd. But, you know, I mean, freedom for a kid living in South Central Los Angeles might very well be just, you know, being able to get to a library without crossing through somebody else's territory and getting an ass kicked. You know, freedom to a nurse might be, you know, just being able to go to work and be a part of a union and get paid for the work that she does or he does, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different ideas about freedom. I think that's what freedom is.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess the first freedom would be the freedom to define for yourself what it means to you.
Exactly. I mean, being able to honor other people's freedoms is pretty key to that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it runs into any conflict or paradox with... obviously, some people are going to want to exercise their freedoms in ways that may interfere or offend the sensibilities of others.
Wait, say it again.
I don't know if that question made sense. Do you think there's any... if we were in some ideal society where everyone were able to define freedom for themselves, some people would probably define it in a way that would interfere with the definitions of others. Do you see any paradox or conflict inherent in the concept?
Well, I mean, yeah, these are deep philosophical discussions, you know. I mean, like, yeah. if your idea of freedom is to axe, murder, and disembowel, you know, anyone you want,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, you might be encroaching on someone else's idea of freedom pretty severely.
Yeah.
You know. you know, I mean, like, I mean, you know, your average capitalist idea of freedom sometimes involves investing or trading or selling or buying stocks that may or may not result in the starvation of, you know, 1.2 million people in Africa. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Based on, you know, one person's decision to buy or sell a certain amount of stocks might influence the destiny of, you know, people across the planet. And so, you know, are we infringing? Whose freedom would be infringed upon here? You know, capitalist has the freedom to invest. And yet the people across the planet have the freedom, you know, should have the freedom to live, but they don't.
Well, sometimes an answer is a question's way of making more questions. I'll try to make things a little more practical. One of the things that you've dealt with is a lot of controversy. And I was wondering how you would tell people who might
how
be...
What?
How you would tell or any advice you might have for people who might be suffering kind of controversy in their lives from their family or their community because they're choosing to act in ways that might cause controversy on a smaller scale than what you've experienced, but still it's a big upheaval in their lives. Do you have anything that's helped you deal with people criticizing or questioning you?
Do you mean just in a general way?
Or anything specific in your own life, or anything general that you might be able to give to other people? Or might be able
well,
to...
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the culture that we're raised in like, actively attack a child's self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
From, like, regardless of, you know, the child's gender, class, race, whatever. And it seems like that's, like, recognizing that, just, like, in a kind of a, in an almost clinical way, just recognizing that is really freeing, you know, and actually gives a person a lot of courage, I think,
yeah,
to look at themselves and the, you know, view their lives objectively and be more patient and gentle, not only with yourself, but also with the people in your community and in your family and stuff like that. It's a really difficult thing to do, I think,
yeah.
Because no one tells you that. You don't get a lot of, even your friends can sometimes be the people who cut you down the most, or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
So, but I don't know. I mean, I look at that a lot, you know, about, I see it all around. Yeah, it's a really sad state of affairs, you know. We're not a society of, like, cooperation and support and bolstering, you know, children and each other and ourselves. It's all about cutting down and competing and, you know. I mean, I find it odd that, like, so many people, when they're naming their child, one of the main considerations seems to be dodging the possibility of other kids having something to tease their kid about, you know?
Yeah.
When they're coming up with names. And it's interesting to me because, like, kids are gonna make fun of each other no matter what, 'cause that's what they see, you know?
Yes.
That mean bullying and teasing and stuff like that, it's just, they see it everywhere around them. You know, so it doesn't matter what your kid's name is. They're gonna, you know, if your kid's gonna get messed with, they're gonna get messed with.
Do you think
naming a kid, you know, Jeffrey Johnson isn't gonna really change that fact? I don't know.
Do you think
is that what you are kind of talking about?
Yeah, I definitely.
I mean, is that what,
well, okay. One thing I'm starting to realize is that everything is interrelated.
Right.
And that. Well, one thing I really like about your writing is that you don't view feminism in a vacuum. You view it in relation to a lot of other issues and ideologies.
Oh, right on.
So,
that's cool.
You know, we can start out... what can start out as a political question can end up... I think a lot of war and oppression do go back to... A lot... I think sometimes wars are just... world leaders acting out their childhood issues on a global stage. Does that make sense? Sometimes. So it all does kind of go back to that. Yeah, and I wanted to talk about your view of the body, because obviously it's something...
You want to talk about what?
Your view of the body, of, like, women's bodies and the human body in general. Because mm-hmm. obviously that was a lot of what your first book was about, a part of the body that society had tried to make shameful and tried to shame the people.
Uh-huh.
I guess I'm just trying to ask what your view in general of the way that society teaches us about our bodies and tries to give us images about bodies, how that affects us and what we can do about it. I know that you wrote a whole book about it, but just... if there's anything else.
Well, I mean, that's kind of like the self-esteem thing.
Yeah.
Is that's kind of what, I mean, I was getting at that, is it, you know, it's, when your self-esteem is attacked from a very young age and you grow up and, you know, you have a body and you're supposed to do certain things with it, there's going to be an enormous amount of, like, confusion or, you know, being sexual in ways that you might not be prepared to be sexual in, as a way to seek out acceptance, or hiding yourself. I mean, there's so many different ways that this can, you know, this attack on a self-esteem can manifest in a person's body. It can manifest in eating disorders. It can manifest in fucking every single human being that you can find to have sex with you. It can manifest in, like, shutting down sexually. It can manifest in, you know, just thousands of ways. I mean, I don't know. That's what I'm saying about, like, just recognizing that your self-esteem is, like, under siege all the time. Turn off the fucking TV. I think that would be a good start in terms of looking at, you know, the way society views a person's body is it's a commodity. It's either a commodity or it's not. You know? If it's not, then you're an unhappy person, right? You can't possibly be a happy person if your body is not one of your assets and commodities in this world. And if it is an asset and a commodity, then you use it to get what you want. I mean, those are basically your choices, aren't they? In our culture?
That was part one of my interview with Inga Muschio, author of Cunt, A Declaration of Independence, and of her forthcoming book, Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Devil, My Life and Times in a Racist Imperialist Society. Keep it right here next week. We will be back with part two of our interview, in which we discuss such issues as whether or not most people have good intentions in the world, and whether or not time travel is possible. This is Philip K. Dick.
Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening to everyone he knew, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem in the circles where he hung out and putting an end to yourself. You just bought into a large quantity of reds and took them with some cheap wine late at night with the phone off hooks so that no one could interrupt you. The tiny part had to do with the artifacts you wanted found on you by later archaeologists, so they'd know from which stratum you came, and also could piece together where your head had been at the time you did it. He spent several days deciding on the artifacts, much longer than he had spent deciding to kill himself, and approximately the same time required to get that many reds. He would be found lying on his back, on his bed, with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which would prove he had been a misunderstood Superman rejected by the masses, and so in a sense murdered by their scorn. And an unfinished letter to Exxon protesting the cancellation of his gas credit card. That way, he could indict the system and achieve something by his death over and above what the death itself achieved. Actually, he was not as sure in his mind what the death achieved as what the artifacts achieved, but anyhow, it all added up, and began to make ready like an animal sensing its time had come and acting out its instinctive programming laid down by nature when its inevitable end was near. At the last moment, as end time closed in on him, he changed his mind on a decisive issue and decided to drink the reds down with a connoisseur wine instead of Ripple or Thunderbird. So he set off on one last drive over to Trader Joe's, which specialized in fine wines, and bought a bottle of 1971 Mondavi Cabernet Sauvignon, which set him back almost $30, all he had. Back home again, he uncorked the wine, let it breathe, drank a few glasses of it, spent a few minutes contemplating his favorite page of the illustrated picture book of sex, which had the girl on top, then placed the baggie of reds beside his bed, lay down with the Ayn Rand book and unfinished protest letter to Exxon, tried to think of something meaningful but could not, although kept remembering the girl being on top, and then with a glass of the Cabernet Sauvignon, dumped down all the reds at once. After that, the deed had been done, he lay back the Ayn Rand book and letter on his chest and waited. However, he had been burned. The capsules were not barbiturates as represented. They were some kind of kinky psychedelic, of a type he had never got before, probably a mixture new on the market. Instead of quietly suffocating, Charles Freck began to hallucinate. Well, he thought philosophically, this is the story of my life, always ripped off. He had to face the fact, considering how many of the capsules he saw, he was in for some trip. Next thing he knew, a creature from between dimensions was standing beside his bed, looking down at him disapprovingly. The creature had many eyes all over it, ultra-modern, expensive-looking clothing, and rose at 8 feet high. Also, it carried an enormous scroll. you're going to read me my sins, Charles Trek said. The creature nodded and unsealed the scroll.